Where does catheter-based ablation fit in decisions about rhythm control?
Well, I think in terms of rhythm control, it's generally a second-line therapy. So a patient who you have chosen a rhythm control strategy, you've tried an antiarrhythmic drug, whether it's dronedarone, whether it's flecainide, propafenone, or amio, you've tried one of those drugs, they have failed. The next option that you have for the patient is either, there are more than this, but in general, would be to try another antiarrhythmic drug or catheter-based ablation. And so I find that in my patients, that's generally the next option. After they fail an antiarrhythmic drug, we'll have a discussion about a catheter-based ablation versus trying another antiarrhythmic drug. And when we speak about catheter ablation, there are different types of catheter ablations. We have talked about with Cindy's patient, the AVJ ablation, in which an ablation was done to disconnect the top and bottom chambers of the heart. That's one type of an ablation. The ablation that we're speaking of for rhythm control strategy is where we put catheters into the left atrium, ablate pretty aggressively around the posterior wall of the left atrium, around the pulmonary veins, and sometimes additional ablation lines or spots that may represent tiny circuits or rotors that may be responsible for the atrial fibrillation. But in general, at least my approach has been second-line therapy after an antiarrhythmic drug.
How are symptoms, quality of life, and risk of hospitalization incorporated into treatment decisions?
Well, I think each patient has to be individualized. I would, in general, say that the more symptomatic the patient is, whether it's the palpitations, whether it's affecting their daily lifestyle, or their fear of going into atrial fibrillation, as we've heard from one of the patients, or repeated hospitalizations. The more symptomatic the patient is, I think the more aggressive our approach generally is. Sometimes the patients can be treated with a simple drug, but sometimes the patient needs an antiarrhythmic drug, sometimes trying different trials of antiarrhythmic drugs, ablation, the combination of ablation plus drugs. I think in general, I would say that the more symptomatic the patient is, the more aggressive we are about the treatment strategy.
You know, this is where science is somewhat limited, because in the clinical trials that evaluated antiarrhythmic agents, the ability of the agent to suppress the arrhythmia constituted the endpoint of the trial. Where the Athena trial is unique is that it incorporated clinical outcomes as the primary endpoint in the trial. And those clinical outcomes were to reduce hospitalization, which it did achieve, and to reduce cardiovascular death. No other drug, as far as I know, has been evaluated in an Athena-like clinical trial. So I think that with dronedarone, it's easier because you have a clinical trial that shows that when you use the drug for an appropriate patient population, i.e. the Athena population, that do not have heart failure, that do not have chronic atrial fibrillation, but have more of the intermittent form, that this drug does improve patient outcome. For the other drugs that we use frequently, there isn't that data. We make the presumption that we do improve patient outcome, but we don't have any direct proof of these. And these are older drugs, so it's unlikely that clinical trials will be done in the future. So, you know, there's a huge unmet need.
Just to get back to a couple of little pieces of your original question, risk is risk of what? Is it the risk of stroke, which is sort of the big bugaboo that we always worry about, or thromboembolism with atrial fibrillation? We are always... what we do is always dictated by the individual's risk of stroke, and that question of anticoagulation, that has to be answered up front. Whether that person goes into rate, rhythm, ablation, that risk of stroke isn't necessarily modified by anything we do. So that's an ongoing thing that we have to manage. Risk of the drugs that we use. It may be better at some point to just back off and say, this drug is now too risky for you. We have to go to a different treatment strategy. Finally, the one thing with hospitalization, when when you talk to a patient, you'll often ask them, well, why did you go to the hospital? What made you go to the hospital? And you can often work with them so that they get a better understanding of their disease process so that they're less likely to go to the hospital. If you can, you know, now obviously you can't stop heart failure from occurring, but you or a person needing to go to the hospital because they've gone into heart failure, but just because an atrial fibrillation patient goes into atrial fibrillation doesn't mean that they have to go to the hospital. If you've modified their risks, you can keep them out of the emergency room, which as we all know, having been patients ourselves probably in ERs, it's not the most fun in the world. We can keep them out of the emergency room or the hospital by giving them strategies or tools that they can use at home before saying, look, I can't do this anymore. I have to go to the hospital. You can give them a pill in the pocket if it's somebody who can respond to a drug and convert safely at home. They can do that. You can give them a rate control medication. Often when they go to the emergency room, all they'll do is hook up an IV and give them some diltiazem. You can give them an oral form of diltiazem that they can take. So you've just kind of have to keep working with the patient to try to improve the quality of life.
There was a post hoc analysis of dronedarone in an Athena population with intermittent atrial fibrillation from Stuart Connolly that suggested that stroke reduction was possible with dronedarone. However, there's a recent trial that was stopped. We don't have a lot of information on this trial in patients with chronic atrial fibrillation that did not do well. So once again, dronedarone, in my view, should not be used in patients that have chronic atrial fibrillation because of new information that is becoming available.
And I would just add, in terms of anticoagulation and ablation, we frequently get referrals or patients will come with the idea that if they have an ablation, then they can come off of their anticoagulation. And right now, we don't have data to say that that's a safe option. So even though the patient had an ablation, and let's say early on it looks like it's a successful ablation, right now the general recommendation is to continue the anticoagulation strategy based upon their risk factors, the CHAD score, regardless of whether or not they've had an ablation. And but I think I certainly see a lot of patients that are directed to ablation just for that purpose. And I try to spend a little time in clinic just sorting those two issues out. So education, as you mentioned, is important.
Given that atrial fibrillation is a serious condition, do you have any strategies or tips that you would encourage for adherence to treatment?
Well, adherence to treatment is critically important, and therefore patient education is critically important. So patients have to be educated as to the importance of taking their medicine as prescribed in order to derive optimal benefit.
If I could just add to that patient education, one thing that we found useful is actually giving patients brochures about atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. And we have nurses also in our clinic that will spend time with them to talk about AFib, what to expect. So patient expectations are at a level that is appropriate.
Yeah, I think the more the patient knows about their condition, the more likely they are going to be able to comply with things. It's complicated. It's an ongoing process. Setting up expectations is very important. They shouldn't panic or feel like the world has ended if they have a recurrence of the arrhythmia. So giving them the expectations, the tools that they need, understanding their medications and understanding their condition.
Well, we've had a very thoughtful and engaging conversation today. I'd like to ask each of you, if you would, just to think of a take-home message for our viewers in regards to the treatment of atrial fibrillation.
Well, I think one of the key points that we all discussed was that the patient needs to be individualized, that they can come to you untreated or undertreated, and a complete evaluation should be undertaken, which looks at their individual risk, but also looking at their symptoms on an individual basis to make your recommendation.
individual basis is the key phrase. Using the guidelines is extremely appropriate. Find what category your patient is in. Is dronedarone right for this person? Is amiodarone better for this person? And really honing in on what's underneath this. What's the cause? What's behind this? Taking care of those things behind. And my big bugaboo is getting the patient involved. Make them responsible. Get them involved in their own care.
Well, we live in an aging population, which is a good thing. We're all going to live longer, and hopefully the quality of our lives will be better. Atrial fibrillation is an epidemic in the aging population, and it's a complex disease. It's associated with worse outcomes compared to comparably aged patients that are not in atrial fibrillation, that are in sinus rhythm, and that I can't emphasize enough that the clinical trials provide general guidance, but individualizing care in this complex patient population is the critical issue, and I think that's the take-home message.
Well, doctors, thank you for participating in our important conversation today, and we'd also like to thank you, our viewers, and hope today's program has helped you better understand the importance of treating atrial fibrillation, especially as it relates to rhythm control. We encourage each of you to go to your computer, log on to discoverychannelcme.com, and take the post-test. It only takes a few minutes to earn free credit for this program. If you'd like to see the program again, you can watch it online, download a podcast, or order a DVD. The graphics and references from this program are also available online, and we've also included some resources for your patients. Finally, I'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program, as well as Sanofi Aventis for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Channel CME. Have a great day.